Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. And wherever you are on your journey, we welcome you. Thank you for being with us today. I'm Carolyn Schlemmer, Worship Associate for today. I'm joined by Reverend Cal Fry, our worship leader, and Reed Parsons, who's providing our music this morning. Lay-led services are a time-honored Unitarian Universalist tradition. We believe that the Sunday service is best reflected in a variety of voices and experiences. Reverend Cal Fry, who is sitting here and known to many of us, works in the IT department at Oberlin College. His background, however, you might not have known this, is in geology and paleontology, having lectured at Kent State University, Tri-C, and at Cleveland Museum of Natural History. He's been a UU for 15 years. He's a former member and continuing friend of this church and is endorsed as a humanist celebrant by the Humanist Society and the American Humanist Association.
Unitarian Universalists and many more believe in God, the goddesses, God's the goddess, nothing at all, ideals and pragmatism. These which create and destroy or stand and call us to where we need or want to be. And with them are the Buddha, Gandhi, Jesus, and other great men and women who are called and not called saints, who are lights to the highest in which we believe, and who stand as light for us for centuries. And also with them are the everyday people who live and work diligently and make the world what it is. And alongside all is the realm of nature, the lives of varied animals and spread of plants, of large and small forces and objects on the planet and swirling in space. And we believe in places for gathering together for worship, where all these gods and people and animals and plants and forces are remembered and renewed in symbol, and where we take what they stand for into our wider lives so that hope exists and the light of the world to come can be built. The light of life shines through the eyes of each and every person. The light of truth shines through each life. May the light of this chalice remind us that our search for truth and light is ongoing and is enhanced and nurtured by every person we meet. May we honor the light in each other.
Okay. Cal will do the opening chant of the Gautama Buddha.
Be ye lamps unto yourselves, be your own confidence. Hold to the truth within yourselves as to the only lamp.
I love that little piece. Encapsulated in four little lines, we have a typical Unitarian Universalist practice. We take what are reported to be the last words of the Buddha. We set them to a line from Gregorian chant. And the message is entirely, be ye lamps unto yourselves. Be your own confidence. It's a great way to begin, I think.
Our call to worship is a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. A person will worship something, have no doubt about that. We may think our tribute is paid in secret in the dark recesses of our hearts, but it will out. That which dominates our imaginations and thoughts will determine our lives and our character. Therefore, it behooves us to be careful what we worship, for what we are worshiping, we are becoming. There's something special about being here together with others that our hearts can beat in empathy with, in time together. We hope that our efforts and thoughts, our efforts both symbolic and practical, can send support to those who are struggling with personal illness, with memories, with struggles in their lives. But as I think of the struggles in my own life and those of others I know and those I don't know, this time of year brings me to joy. I think of corn and tomatoes and cucumbers and beans and the harvest that is beginning to burst upon us. How much there is. There's more than enough. And I hope that that will suffuse my thoughts and my behavior and allow me to know that when I take just what I need, not out of greed, that there is enough for everyone.
As we emerge satiated from our meditation, let us sing together another of Reverend Vincent Silliman's fine hymns. Although he was a Unitarian and not a Universalist, I think these are some of the nicer hymns in our collection and still express Universalist sentiments for us this morning. So this one is number 287, Faith of the Larger Liberty. Would you rise as you are willing and able? This one deserves to be belted out with gusto. Thank you. One reason we sing hymns is to look past our differences and recognize we are a congregation gathered together for an hour or so of our free will to do things together. So, I come from Methodist and Universalist stock. My grandmother was an Olin, and you can find dozens by that name on church rolls throughout the Western Reserve and beyond. Several of my direct and collateral ancestors are recorded on the original charter of this church, and others were pillars of the Akron Church, and those are just the ones I know of. Universalism has always been the neglected stepchild of the Unitarian Universalist combination, the second U, often being left off altogether as we shorten it for convenience to just Unitarian. It doesn't help that Unitarian Universalism is 10 syllables. And Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent, Ohio has more syllables than supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even my computer's spell checker, which fully accepts supercalifragilisticexpialidocious as a legitimate word, doesn't know how to spell universalist. While the Unitarians were the Eastern elite, Universalists were more often found on the farms and fields here in the Midwest. Unitarians came from Harvard, and the Universalists often had to create their colleges from scratch. My great-grandfather was among the founding faculty of Buchtel College, founded by the Universalists in 1870 in Akron. They, like many of their time, were seeking education in Ohio that fell along their religious principles, and it felt necessary to build their own. It lasted several decades, but in 1907, the college severed its religious relationships in order to be able to accept financial support from the Carnegie Foundation. In 1913, the college was sold to the city and became the Municipal University of Akron, where I gather they still have the occasional monetary problem today. It's hard work, education. John Murray famously was driven ashore in 1770 to found Universalism in America, first in New Jersey and later in Massachusetts alongside the Congregationalists. He had been thrown out of the Methodists over his theology, and the standing order of churches in New England were rather hostile to interlopers of other denominations, so it was not an entirely comfortable road he was on. Universalism didn't receive a warm-hearted welcome in the Midwest either, despite this becoming the center of Universalist activity in the 19th century. It was common for small communities, strapped for resources in those days, to come together and build a single church to be shared by several congregations. Ministers were either local lay folk or circuit riders, riding or walking during the week from church to community church to preach in a different locality every Sunday. I've heard several stories of instances where the Methodists and the Universalists came together to build a church, only to have the Methodists throw the Universalists out over their theology once the building was complete. As this isn't a happy event in any church's history, I've been unable to substantiate these stories, at least with a simple scan of internet histories. Oberlin College, my employer, was itself founded as a religious institution back when the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists were flirting. The college wound up with a peculiar theology of its own, thanks to Reverend Charles Grandison Finney. We read a congregational covenant moments ago. Once all Oberlin settlers were required to agree to the Oberlin Covenant before being granted residence. That document begins lamenting the degeneracy of the church and established a sort of Christian socialism, including restricting the settlers to a diet of plain and wholesome food, renouncing all bad habits, especially tobacco, not to mention strong beverages like tea and coffee. Just think on that a moment. This, after all, is the town that started Prohibition. Indeed, in the earliest years of the college, everyone followed the diet of Reverend Sylvester Graham, which was nearly vegan in nature, and coincidentally is responsible for giving us the original Graham cracker, which now has way more sugar in it than Sylvester thought was proper. A student revolt brought this diet to an end around 1841. So what did Oberlin think of Universalists in the area? I found a student history of Oberlin from 1837, and it recounts this tale. Captain Tracy of Huntington, in the south part of Lorain County, was returning from a journey and reached Oberlin in the evening. Being some 10 or 15 miles yet from home, he concluded to make application to some of the colonists for entertainment during the night. To come to the sequel, being interrogated as to his religious sentiments, and it being ascertained by them that he was a Universalist, he was denied refreshment or entertainment of any kind, and there being no public house in the place at the time, he was obliged to pursue his journey amid darkness, rough roads, and the inclemency of the weather. I might advance very many cases tending to show their almost unparalleled superstition, intolerance, and barbarous persecutions. Hard as it may be to appreciate today, the problem with the Universalists was the very core tenet of their theology. Imagine the image of the Wild West in the Northwest Territories back in the day. Ohio's main export in the Erie Canal days was corn whiskey. Now consider yourself a revivalist preacher, bravely setting off to save those poor wretched souls battling it out on the frontier. If you're comfortable with the fire and brimstone hell and damnation line, your aim is to scare those scoundrels into believing and good behavior with the threat of eternal perdition which surely awaits them without your kind and gentle message. Or if you are a Universalist, you go to tell everyone that God is so good and kind that there is no hell, and everyone, Every man, woman, and child can go to meet their Maker without fear, as they are guaranteed a place in heaven. Luke says, after all, in chapter 3, verse 6, that all flesh shall see the salvation of God. And many times Paul says in the letters that Jesus did not save merely his followers alone, but everyone. What if you hadn't heard the message, or did but didn't believe? Universalists were certain that you were saved anyway. Universalists were derided as the no-hellers. And they were held in suspicion by the hell and damnation types as potentially wanton, people who might go off sinning at any moment without the thought of hell to keep them in line. What's a good universalist to do? Well, as it turns out, at its core, universalism is a downright attractive theology. So much so that you can find a very universalist form of Christianity present in many mainline Protestant churches today, although not everyone is comfortable with that situation. A few years ago, a pastor from Grand Rapids wrote a book called Love Wins, in which many thought dangerously universalist in character. Reverend Rob Bell made national headlines with that book, which might have helped his book sales, but got him in a bit of hot water with his congregation. And while I was casting about for ideas for this sermon, I found a fascinating article online at a blog titled Juicy Ecumenism. This article was bemoaning the attempted Unitarian universalization of the United Methodist Church. Imagine that one. The universalist message is attractive precisely because it is one of universal love. Love for me, love for you, the love of God for his creation, love that wins and makes something beautiful by the end of the story. Of course, if other liberal Protestant churches feel themselves in danger of becoming universalist, I suppose it's understandable that in Unitarian Universalism, we pay annoyingly little attention to our Universalist members. The two most common criticisms of U.S. congregations are that we fail to welcome Christians and conservatives. We usually begin services with a statement that all those of goodwill are welcome here with us, whatever their origins, whatever their loves. I'm afraid that still needs to be repeated, not just for the visitor, but for the longtime member too. This is our goal, what the first principle says about us. And this is what our universalist ancestors had to say too. Here, we should be welcoming to everyone who is willing to honor the covenant we hold with each other, willing to honor the seven principles, and to not neglect the earliest of our six sources, that one that specifically calls us to love our neighbors. Check the first few pages of your hymnal. It's not enough to look to new prophets if we neglect or forget the wisdom of the old. And it's not enough to spread our particular version of the good news only to the Prius-driving, recycling, socialist, New Age Buddhists, or humanists like ourselves, if we are going to be holier than thou and unwelcoming to Republican Universalists who might otherwise find a home even with us here in Kent. We are called to love people, and that means everyone.
Before we move on to the offering, we need to get some announcements in. One of things that are happening this week, this coming Saturday, is the first of the Cuyahoga River Concert Series with Magpie. There's more information about that downstairs and in your insert. So that's this coming Saturday. Also this coming Saturday at 4 o'clock is a new member picnic. Does anybody have more information about that? Well, new member picnic this Saturday at 4. Watch online for more information. And I think Kim has an announcement. Magpie. All right. Very good. Will the ushers please come forward? The offering will now be received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values.
Thank you.
So I've invited you all to be more universalist with me this morning. Pretty funny thing for an atheist humanist, don't you think? We make a thing of the first humanist manifesto, not only having been written by Unitarians, but half the signers were Unitarians too. Were there no universalists among them? Why us? There were a few. I'd like for there to have been more, but I wasn't there to spur them on. There's the old joke about the UU that succeeded in dragging his friend to church with him one Sunday morning. First, imagine that. But you know this one. It's the one where the visitor finds it a very funny church, where the only time he heard the words Jesus Christ was when someone discovered the coffee had run out at social hour. I suppose you have us humanists to thank for that one. Today's Unitarian Universalism is a big tent, but even then, there's a tendency for some group, any and all groups probably, at one time or another, to feel pushed out, away from the center. Despite the scolding that I've just given you, humanists too have spent their time feeling left out of where the UUA is going. Some of us thought we had eradicated all of the God talk from our churches, and were genuinely upset when Reverend Bill Sinkford started lecturing on the language of reverence back around the turn of the century. Sounds like ancient history put like that, doesn't it? As an example, a recent issue of Religious Humanism that I have handy contains an article titled, "Can an Atheist Be Prophetic?" and others which attempt to navigate the shifting waters we feel on our language and theology in what we thought was our church. One of the articles, however, examines the new atheist communities that are forming, like the Sunday assemblies and other secular gatherings, and confidently this article states that Unitarian Universalism is a habitat for humanists. Of course it is. And I think it's the universalist side that makes that happen, not just the Unitarian. In his article, Humanism's Breaking Heart, Josh Pavlik begins by saying, "Humanism is the term we use within Unitarian Universalism for atheism." But he also says this is a trap. When we say this, we risk missing what humanism is really all about. Humanism is about the free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, the goal of world community, along with our search for justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and even that respect for the interdependent web of all existence. Yes, I'll take credit for the inherent worth and dignity of every person, too. These principles are not exclusively humanist in nature, but the language of the seven principles draws deeply from the humanist well of the mid-century. But humanism is dry, cold, too rational, uninviting, overly intellectual and scientific. A religion for thinking, not for feeling, not a religion for dirty hands. It's a trap, too, to blame these opinions for the perceived decline in humanism within our congregations today. Humanists fight back by accusing the UUA and Sinkford and the rest for abandoning us in a search for a renewed theism. As is so often the case, both sides are a little bit right and a whole lot wrong. Another old joke at our expense is the one about Unitarian Universalists skipping the bus to heaven in order to attend the discussion group about heaven. Humanists relish the thought of a good debate, and we look to that free and responsible search for truth and meaning as an excuse to quiz you on your beliefs in coffee hour and compare them to our own. Ours are always superior, of course, right? But Reverend Pavlik reminds us that not everyone has time in their lives to really sit down and think their theology through in a rigorous manner. Does God exist? I don't know. I gotta run to the store because we're out of milk and cat litter. Kid number one is taekwondo at 5. Kid number two has soccer at 6. I'll drop off if you pick up. Who's making dinner? I can't. I have to stay late at work. Oh, the check engine light is on again, honey. Send me an email because I'm not going to remember. Did you remember to pay the mortgage? Mom looked so tired the other day. And Mrs. Allen is in the hospital again. Oh, this phone won't stop ringing. I'm yelling too much at the kids. They deserve better. I can't even pay attention to Syria anymore. I can't stand what's happening with Congress. Could you believe that debate the other night? This weather is really awful. I can't do another week without power. What? Wait. What time is soccer? God, I'm so tired. When humanists knock God off the pedestal at the center of our theology, we often keep the pedestal and we put some kind of an idealized humanity up there instead. Pavlik reminds us that none of us is perfect in ourselves to take such a position, no matter how much we might wish that it would be true that we could stand up there at the center. He fears that that ideal person that we would put up there on the pedestal may lack vulnerability, lack the ability to admit mistakes or wrongdoing or errors in judgment, or just the ability to say, I don't know, I'm confused. If we attempt to deify humanity, we forget we're human. The Texas philosopher Paul Woodruff would agree with Singford and say that we have forgotten at that point how to be reverent. We hold so strongly to our notion of humanism, we can forget to reserve a place for the humans. No pedestal, no center. Here too, the Universalists had it right. A couple of logos ago, the UUA used a chalice surrounded by two circles to represent the merger of the two faiths. One particular feature of this chalice was retained from the Universalists, for back in 1946, they took as their logo a cross within a circle. But the Universalist cross was carefully and deliberately placed off-center in that circle, acknowledging the Christian origins of universalism while explicitly leaving room for the growth of humanism and the teachings they shared with other religions. The off-center chalice in the merger logo also made room for humanism and other religious paths within what we now call Unitarian Universalism. I regret losing our sight of that symbolism in the recent logo changes. So is humanism a religious path? Certainly it is. There is a language of reverence that is fully humanist, for humanism at its best is also universalist in nature. Not so much with an idealized, abstract humanity in the center, but leaving room for real humans there instead. Remembering that reality while striving for better is what you find in the language of reverence. Theodore Parker was a Unitarian, but we still believe with him that the arc of the moral universe may be long, but it bends toward justice, and it bends that way because real human hands are pulling on it. As Pavlik says, real human beings have their hearts broken again and again. Real human beings often come into churches with heartbreaking stories of pain, illness, loss, shattered dreams, and unmet expectations. Real human beings often come into our congregations looking for ways to serve the larger community, looking for ways to address social and economic injustices, looking for ways to build beloved community, all because they've had their hearts broken in some way. And whether they can articulate it or not, and regardless of what they believe or how well they can defend that belief, they want to work on behalf of healing for themselves, for others, for their community, for the nation, for the world. Humanism is universalist, for we believe everyone is somewhere on the same path. Everyone is simultaneously saved from damnation and somehow fallen from grace. We differ from the universalists only in the nature and mechanism of that salvation, but we are united in the belief that we are all in this together, and we're here to help each other get through. Every last one of us is worthy, and no God worth our time or consideration would damn any one of us. Love is what is universal. And as Cornel West said, justice is what love looks like out in public. Thanks to universalism and what I would call its reflection within humanism, we have in our lives the profound blessing of spiritual freedom. But let us not waste that freedom fighting over our beliefs. Let's use that freedom to mend broken hearts. For the ecologist and Buddhist scholar Jhana Macy expresses a profound truth. The heart that breaks open can contain the whole universe. May it be so. Oh heck, not all of the good times in the hymnal are set with words by Reverend Silliman. Let's have a go at number 360 in our hymnal for our final song. The music is from the 16th century, but let's remember that they wrote many good dance tunes back then as well. Our time of worship is ended now. Soon we will leave this sacred space and go our separate ways, going in peace and unrest, returning to the distractions, joys, and struggles of our daily lives. As we go, may the fabric of this community continue to unfold us. Its support and compassion comfort us in our pain. Its diversity fuel our growing and our deepening. Its joy open our senses to the beauty around us. Its passion for justice strengthen our resolve to serve. And may its love surround us and hold us until we meet again.